romance adventure, and the 2019 winner of the Daphne du Maurier Award for Mystery and Suspense, the 2019 Stiletto Award for Romantic Suspense, and the 2019 National Excellence in Romance Fiction Award for Romantic Suspense. When she is not creating new worlds or fostering the epic love of fictional characters, she can be found in the Midwest enjoying her blessed Midwestern life and probably plotting murder with her shamelessly enabling friends. Today she hopes to make someone smile, and one day she plans to change the world. And last, we have Vicki Delaney. She's one of Canada's most prolific and varied crime writers and national bestsellers in the U.S. She has written more than 40 books, clever cozies to gothic thrillers to gritty police procedurals, historical fiction, and novellas for adult literacy. She's currently writing for a mystery series, the Tea by the Sea Mysteries, which is the one that came out 2 days ago, for Kensington, the Sherlock Holmes Bookshop series for Crooked Lane Books, the Catskill Resort Mysteries coming this fall for Penguin Random House, and the Lighthouse Library series as Eva Gates for Crooked Lane Books. Vicki is the past president of the Crime Writers of Canada and co-founder and organizer of Women Killing It Crime Writing Festival. Her work has been nominated for the Derringer, the Boney Blythe, the Ontario Literary Association Golden Oak, and the Author Ellis Awards. And Vicki is the recipient of the 2019 Derek Murdoch Award for contributions to Canadian crime writing. And now that I've read all your accolades, we're out of time. Good morning and welcome very much. Thank you so much for joining me, and thanks again to Larissa Ackerman for setting this up from Kensington. So would you each like to talk a little bit about the book and the series that came out on Tuesday? Sherry, I introduced you first, so.
Okay. So here it is, A Time to Swill, and it is a second in the Chloe Jackson Sea Glass Saloon Mysteries. And Chloe is out for a morning run, and it's all foggy out, and she sees this sailboat washed up against a sandbar. She thinks she hears a baby cry, so she calls 911, but she doesn't want to wait, and so she climbs on board, and the sailboat gets swept out to sea. And then she discovers it was cat crying, not a baby. But she also finds the remains of a skeleton on the ship. And I kind of based this on a true story that happened in the panhandle of Florida near Destin. A sailboat washed up on the beach, and it washed back out, and then it washed back up further down the beach. And it was abandoned, and they call them ghost ships, which I think is kind of cool. So I used that. But then Chloe finds out that there's a connection between the bones and the disappearance of one of her friend's wife's 12 years ago. So that's the basic premise for A Time to Swill.
Julie, would you like to talk about yours?
Sure. This is Cider Shop Rules. This is book three in my Cider Shop Mysteries. It's set in a small rural town in the Blue Ridge Mountains of West Virginia. The series is kind of, I call it a love letter to my dad, who was born and raised there and moved to Ohio for work, like I think a lot of people did. And he met my mom, and I was raised here, but every weekend, every summer, we were back in West Virginia in these tiny little towns that just feel like their own planet, you know, compared to everything else I knew. So I'm writing this for him, and this book three is set in the fall. It takes place on Granny Smith's orchard, apple orchard, and the main character, Winona Mae Montgomery, Winnie, she opens a cider shop in an old mailhouse barn, mail pouch. I don't know if you guys are familiar. That was something I grew up with too, and I realized that they're really just in a certain area down through the Ohio Valley and here and there otherwise, and so I worked the mail pouch barn into it. She opens a cider shop to help Granny's orchard stay afloat. In this episode, she goes to the local pumpkin patch to pick up some things for the orchard, and when she leaves, there's a body in the back of the pickup truck. So that is how she gets drawn in to the murder.
Okay, and Vicki, this is your second in the series?
This is the second in the Teen by the City Mystery, so I'll hold it up there. So as you can see, it illustrates pretty well on the cover, the setting. It's set in Cape Cod. And it's about tea. That's Tea of Treachery you're showing on the screen, which is the first one.
Oops, I'm sorry.
That's perfectly okay. Well, Tea of Treachery was the first. Murder in a Teacup is the new one. And it is exactly what it said. Tea by the Sea is the name of a traditional afternoon tea room that our protagonist, Lily Roberts, has opened. It's brand new. She's just opened it because she's come to Cape Cod to help her grandmother. Her grandmother bought a grand Victorian mansion on the shores of Cape Cod Bay that she could not afford. But she wanted this house that she can't afford, and the only way that she can keep it going is she turns it into a B&B. So she's running this B&B, and Lily has come to set up her little tea shop on the grounds. So this book, this series is heavily drenched in afternoon tea. Lots of the scenes are set in the tea room, and scones are made, and pastries are made, and sandwiches are made, and tea is served. And everyone has tea, and also up at the B&B. So it's very much a afternoon tea series. And in the second book in the series, a family friends of Rose Campbell, by the way, is the name of the grandmother. Rose's friends, longtime friends from Iowa, come for a visit, and it's a family holiday, and the family doesn't get on very well. There's lots of strife. One of the members of the family married into a lot of money, which has created a real division in the family. And, of course, the strife escalates into murder because the deceased appears to have died from something he consumed when the family had an afternoon tea by the sea. Lily and Rose get involved in trying to save Lily's tea room because no one is going to come to a tea room if the tea is full of deadly poison.
Okay. So your Vicki and Julie, both your series grandmothers feature prominently in them. Can you talk a little bit about what made you decide to make the granddaughter grandmother relationship?
Yeah, in my series, it sort of gave Lily a reason to step out of her environment. She is a culinary school trained pastry chef. She has cooked in Michelin-starred restaurants. She's worked in bakeries in Manhattan. She is absolutely from Manhattan. She's never lived anyplace else but Manhattan until she comes to Cape Cod, which for her is the countryside. This remote little, this little town in Cape Cod. So the fact that she's come to help her grandmother is the reason for her to be there. Her grandmother is from Iowa. She's actually Rose is originally from England. She grew up in Yorkshire. She was a kitchen maid in a stately British home. She married an American serviceman when she met him. They collided on the main streets, and after he got out of the hospital, she visited him, and they eventually married. She came to Iowa. But being an English woman, she missed the sea. Let's say she missed the sea enormously. So when her husband died, she did move to Cape Cod, and she bought this house because it reminded her of the sort of places that she had worked in her childhood, but as I mentioned, that she can't afford. So grandmother gives Lily not only a reason to have come there, but I like drawing the contrast between them. Lily, in fact, is the practical one, and Rose, the grandmother, is the sort of the wild one, if you will. Rose goes herring off in all directions. It's Rose who figures they have to solve these mysteries. Lily doesn't want anything to do with it. Lily wants to work at her in her tea room and help her grandmother run her business. So I also think there's a little bit of we tend to think of the younger people as being the wild ones and the steady hand of the grandmother. And in this series, I've kind of made it the opposite. So I enjoyed that little twist. Good.
In my series, Granny Smith was really the mother figure for Winnie. She and her husband had one child, a daughter who just was, I don't know. She ran off as a teen. She came back pregnant and had the baby, and she ran off a couple more times before she finally came back and left without her daughter. So the grandparents stepped in and raised the child. And I guess I wanted to show or just to kind of explore or even feature a different kind of family. You know, a lot of the books I read with families, it's very traditional, the traditional family. And I thought it would be nice to kind of explore the bond between, you know, a different, not direct biological parents. And then the age difference does play a big role. And just I worked a lot of just the family ties in there. And then in the small kind of working class farming community, family is really everything, not just in your direct family, but in the community as a family. So it just worked.
Okay. In each of your series, settings play such a huge role. How did you decide about the setting? Sherry, in your garage sale mysteries, was she the Army wife?
Air Force.
So they, I knew I was going to get the branch wrong. So they moved around quite a bit. But now this series is set firmly in Florida.
Right. So with the garage sale mysteries, we were actually stationed in Bedford, Massachusetts, which is about 15 miles west of Boston. And I did not want to move there, but I fell in love with it. And I adored the quirky way people said things and, you know, how they call sprinkles jimmies and grocery carts carriages. And so when I got the opportunity to write that series, I wanted to set it there because I loved it so much. And then with the new series, the Chloe books, when my editor and I were tossing around this idea of doing a series set on a beach in a bar, he had originally suggested Key West, but I had never been there. And but we had been stationed in the panhandle of Florida, and my parents had moved down there in the early 90s, so I spent a lot of time there and asked if we could set it there instead. Because it also, there's a saying about Florida that the farther north you go, the more southern it gets. And so there is that very southern heritage in the northern panhandle of Florida.
And Julie, you, I think, kind of sort of alluded to the community, which is
right.
So
it's, I picked the Blue Ridge Mountains for my dad. I wanted to set some books there.
Okay. And Vicki, I think you talked about how Cape Cod became your city.
This series was set in Cape Cod, mainly because I needed a tourist area. As I've said, that Rose owns a B&B. Rose wanted to live by the sea because she's an English woman. But also particularly for the afternoon tea. I mean, afternoon tea as we have it today is very, very much an indulgence. It's expensive. Yeah, properly served afternoon tea is expensive because it's served, you know, with good food, and it's served well in a good environment and all that. And it's intended to be a treat and an indulgence. So it's something that people tend to enjoy more when they're on vacation. So I did want a tourist spot. And because my Sherlock Holmes bookshop series was already set on Cape Cod, I just simply created a different fake town that I called North Augusta and put it in a different area of Cape Cod. And that's where it is today.
So each of you write multiple series, and each of you have multiple characters. How do you keep them straight? And Julianne, you write in different genres, completely different genres. Vicki writes different subgenres of mysteries, but you write in romance and mystery. So how do you plot everything?
I plot to death all the things. But as far as keeping the, I mess up details, and my readers let me know all the time. This house was pink, and now it's blue. And I go, well, you know. <I'm turning. laughs> But as far as keeping the actual character straight, it's really not hard. It's really not hard. When you think about how many people you know in your life or how many TV shows you watch, we spend a lot of hours, especially in series, with each of these characters, developing them and their dynamics and arc, their personal arc, their dynamics with the other characters. And they're very real to the writers. I think they become individual people, you know. So it's not hard to to remember, to keep the character straight. It's those smaller details that get a little lost for me sometimes.
Sherry, how about you?
Yeah, I don't have too much of a problem because I deliberately set out to make Sarah and Chloe as different as possible. Sarah is 38 at the beginning of the series, and she's newly divorced and setting up this business. And Chloe is 28, and she goes to Emerald Cove because of a promise she made to a friend that if anything happened to him in Afghanistan, that she would go down and help his grandmother in this beach bar, never thinking that she would have to do that. You know, it was just kind of the, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that. And when she gets down to Florida, she finds out that this grandmother that she's picturing, this helpless little lady, is really the strong Southern woman. And so it's been easy for me too. But Julie, I'm so glad to hear you say that about the details, because I actually renamed a character by accident between book two and between book one and book two. So it was close, but I can't believe I missed that.
But it's not just you. That's the part that gives me some, like, break. Like, I feel frenzied because I'm doing so many things, but when you think of the books go through three rounds of edits, and then proofreaders, and then ARC readers, and then, so it's not just us, it's all the humans.
My audio narrator is actually the one that caught it, which I was like, oh no!
How about you, Vicky? Do you plot things?
My problem, like, I write four series at a time. My sort of problem is distinguishing their voices, and I feel that I could get their voices confused if I didn't pay a pretty strict attention, because even though all four are cozy series, the characters themselves are very different. As I mentioned, Lily Roberts in the Tea by the Sea series just wants to run her tea room. Gemma Doyle in the Sherlock Holmes Bookshop series is the Sherlock Holmes character, therefore she rushes out to get involved whether anybody wants her to or not, and the other two are quite different as well. But the way that I mostly do that is I very strictly write one book from beginning to end. I don't even think about what's coming next. Like, if I feel an edge of an idea, I would actually push it away rather than explore it. You get interrupted. Yeah, you get edits back from one series while you're working on another. So I have to stop writing the new one and do the edits and that. But I find that if I do write, I know some writers who say that they write a little bit of one book, a little bit of another, a little bit of one, a little bit of another. I could never do that. So the ones I'm into writing the book, the characters' voices start to come to me. But I do consciously try and remember that they do have their own quirks and their own individual personalities separate from each other.
Now, Vicky and Julie, you're writing for several different publishers. So maybe this question isn't quite as pertinent to you, but do your characters ever cross over and visit? For instance, Vicky, would somebody from your Sherlock Holmes mysteries ever visit?
Yeah. I've never had anybody actually cross over, but I did have one of my characters come back from vacation wearing a T-shirt that he had bought at the Sherlock in the Lighthouse Library series, written by me as Ian Gates. One of the characters, as I said, come back from vacation, and he's wearing a T-shirt that he bought at the Sherlock Holmes bookshop in Emporium on Cape Cod. So I would actually like that, well, particularly with the two series that are set on Cape Cod, but they're different publishers, so that's probably not going to happen, but it would be kind of fun. But.
So I did a thing that I did not ask for permission first to do. You heard it here, folks. I had this beloved cozy series that I wrote for Crooked Lane. It was called the Kitty Couture Mysteries, and it was set in New Orleans, and it was my first kind of big break cozy series, so to say. I loved them. I loved them so much. I had ideas for dozens of books. I wanted to live there. So it's been years later, having trouble letting these characters go. And just sort of impulsively and a little selfish. And I still get emails from people that are picking these books up at the library wanting to know if there's more when the last book came out you know, 2.5 years ago, but they're just now finding them. But anyway, so I wrote them into this book we're talking about today. I had them at the Civil War reenactment with a friend in West Virginia, and I had a little scene where I got to revisit them. So it's only a couple pages. Hopefully I'm not in trouble, but it did my writer soul good to see them again. And I think it'll be a little Easter egg for the people that, you know, were wanting that series and find their beloved characters unexpectedly in a total different part of the country in a different series. So we'll see what happens.
Sherry, how about you?
So it's interesting that you asked that, because in A Time to Swill, I actually do give a little nod to the Sarah series. So Sarah is divorced in the first book. Spoiler alerts ahead. But she and her ex-husband have this very complicated relationship, and they think about getting back together, but he finally says, I'm moving down to Fort Walton Beach to be the chief of police in Florida. And I think that's in the fourth book. And I had no idea at that time I'd ever be writing a series set there. So I have him make a very brief appearance in A Time to Swill, which was really fun to do. And I have to tell you, Vicki, I'm an Iowa native, and Iowa's so underrepresented in the cozy world. I'm really glad to hear there's somebody from Iowa in a book.
Oh, it's actually presented as a place that she's happy to get away from. Grand Lake, Iowa.
Oh, well. I always think about moving back until I see the weather. So.
So, here's a question. Do you ever introduce a character with the intent on killing them maybe in the next book? Or has a minor character gotten so out of control that you just really, they have to go?
I've never killed the minor character off. I did, don't want to give any spoiler alerts because this is upcoming. In the Lighthouse Library series, one of the minor characters right from book one, was just not working. She was meant to be a minor character anyway, but I was struggling with her. And then I hit upon a great idea of having her basically fall in love with this man. And there's something kind of fishy about him and the protagonist, Lucy in that series. Got confused there. Is pretty suspicious that he's involved in the murder and that her friend is going to have her heart broken and all that. Because it's a cozy series, I wanted to end with a happy ending. So in fact, it all turns out okay. And that if it was not a cozy series, I might well have bumped off this minor character that wasn't working out for me. Instead, I have her leave the Outer Banks in a very good way. She's gone off to be with this guy. Killing off characters in a cozy series is a mighty difficult thing to do. Yeah.
I killed the mayor in one of my series.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. Right. It does my heart good.
He was a thorn, a thistle for books one and two, just the way he wanted things his way. And so he was very background. We didn't really talk to him. We talked about him. And in book three, we got a new one.
That's funny.
I'm very happy to hear that. One of your things on your website says you want to make someone smile today, and you've made me smile.
Yay.
I like that.
So how do you find ways or think of new ways to kill people, murder people? You know, all of you have beverages in your books, so that seems the easy way out. Yeah. But people are going to stop showing up at your places of business.
I'm actually having a lot of trouble right now coming up with not only new ways to kill people, new and interesting ways to kill people, but motives and red herrings. You know, how many times can you and there are actually limitless times of ways of doing this, but I'm having trouble finding all those limitless ways. Yeah, I'm starting to be worried that I'm running out of ideas. Everybody says, where do you get your ideas? In the beginning of my career, oh, ideas are everywhere. I'm now running out. So if anybody knows where the ideas factory is, please send me data. How about you guys?
I haven't ever poisoned anybody. I'm not saying I never will, but I don't know. I think, like, with the garage sale mysteries, there was opportunities to use lots of different objects that may or may not have been at a garage sale. So, so far, so good. But, yeah, if anybody has the address to the Idea Factory, I'll meet you all there.
And Julie, do you?
I don't know. So far, I'm good on ideas. I try to pick something anyone could do. That's about it. You know, I try to make it so that the means doesn't automatically discount anybody in particular.
Thing about a cozy series too, right? We don't really have qualms. Not very often are there series. There's nothing terribly gory like a dismemberment or you know, hiding the body parts in the fridge like that. So we are limited. In fact, the way you said that, something that almost anybody could do. Yeah. And also, like, a knife is fine, but if the person is seen at the scene, and you know, they're either covered in blood or they're not, right? You know, so you have to be careful about that kind of stuff too. So, yeah.
So how did you all want to be writers from child? Did you read mysteries as children, or did you just kind of come into this?
I'll start this. I never, ever, ever thought of being a writer. I never even thought about where my books came from. Gave people doing what we're doing absolutely zero thought. And then I was in my early 30s. I had 3 kids. I had no time for myself or a shower. I was kind of miserable in the part that everyone said was going to be so fantastic. And I picked up a fiction, you know, something fiction. It wasn't like self-help and how to be a better wife and all this stuff that made me feel worse. I picked up a novel and I had the greatest escape that I needed so badly. So when I put it down, I thought, I want to do this for somebody else. So that was where it started for me. I just started writing. I've been working on it since then.
Yeah, your story is kind of, in a way, it's almost kind of the same for me. I have 3 daughters, all grown up now, and I have grandchildren. But I never wanted to be a writer, never really thought about being a writer. But one year, and I don't know where the idea came from, I guess maybe I didn't have a lot of money. I wanted a nice, you know, presents for my children. So I thought I would write them a story. And I did. I wrote a children's story. And I used their names, you know, as the characters and printed it out, tied that up with a little red ribbon to make a book. And that was like their Christmas gift. And I think they liked that. They were, you know, preteens at that time. So that was kind of exciting for them. So then I thought, oh, I like this. So I signed up at my local community college. I worked for a big Canadian bank at the time, and they used to, I hope they still do, they would pay for any sort of adult education that you wanted to take. You know, they considered any education to be something worth pursuing, so they paid for me to take these courses. I still was working. I did it my own time in creative writing at the local community college. And I really quickly realized that I didn't want to write for children. I didn't particularly like the world of children's writers. But I was enjoying taking the course, so I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll try something else. Can I write? Oh, I read mystery novels. I'll try and write a mystery novel specifically for this course. And then I took another course, and I developed that book more, which has never seen the light of day, but that's fine. And that's what all started there.
I a little different. When I was young, my favorite books were the Betsy Tacy books by Maud Hart Lovelace. And Betsy wanted to be a writer, and so I always wanted to be a writer. And I always wrote stories when I was a kid and stuff. And I was in marketing for a while, and so even though that wasn't fiction writing, it was kept my hand. Well, maybe it was fiction writing, but it kept my hand in the writing world. And then when my husband was in the Air Force and we were moving all the time, it was really hard to have any kind of career. And we were living in Ohio. And I saw a little ad for a short story contest. So I decided to enter. But instead of writing a short story, I kept writing and writing and writing and realized I was writing a novel. And which was my practice book, apparently, because it's never sold, and it probably never probably doesn't need to see the light of day, but I did. It was also about an Air Force spouse, so some of it was very good for the Sarah series.
So, okay, when you've got a manuscript that you think is ready to go out to the world, what did you do next? What groups did you join?
You mean when we were starting out?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, well, this creative writing course that I was taking, so I ended up going taking several courses. They offered a certificate, so I actually have, if anybody's interested, in a certificate in creative writing. So the you know, and the people who led the courses were generally published authors or writers of some sort. So they had lots of, you know, they told us about, and this was in the days where you printed things off on a chunk printer and put it in a big envelope with a self-addressed stamp envelope and a stamp in the corner and mailed, you know, 100 pages away. And so they taught us all about how to do that. And things, of course, have changed enormously since, but the principle is all still the same. Plus, in one of the classes, some of the class members after the class was over sort of asked if we wanted to get together to continue the sort of critiquing process. So I did do that at the beginning, joined a few critique groups. And then I joined the Crime Writers of Canada, I joined Sisters in Crime that you are members of as well. And those groups are invaluable for networking and for, you know, learning some of the tricks of the trade and learning what's happening and all that. So you know, I'm a big fan of networking, and I often tell beginning writers that it's important to get involved in these sort of groups to meet these people, to find out what's happening, to also just to make friends in the business. So, went from there.
Julie, how about you?
I started by just Googling how to write a novel, how to write a book, and I read everything I could find online. It was a lot of industry stuff, but it was also agents had blogs. We're talking maybe 10 years ago now, right? Maybe. So, and then and I read author blogs or wannabe author blogs and newbie blogs. And then I started a newbie blog. And so what I learned, I would share. And I went to conferences that came to Ohio, library things that were free. Anytime an author was speaking about how they got started, I kind of just listened and took notes. And I was, meanwhile, I was sending queries to agents because I learned that's how you try to get your book published. And my first, like, five novels were trash, but I didn't know it. I had no idea. I didn't know what I didn't know. So while that wasn't working for me, I Googled submissions, open submissions, submission calls, and I found some small press that was taking submission calls for some new line that they wanted to start up. And they liked my submission, and they let me write some a couple short stories, and then a couple novellas, and then a couple novels. And that really made all the difference, because I was working with the same freelance editors that were working with much larger authors, you know, and so I feel like they kind of trained me, directed me. And then I worked with Carina Press, which is one of many, like, Lyrical Press, where you can, you don't need an agent to submit. And then same thing, I listened to what those editors said when they gave me feedback, and my craft is just from having that one-on-one directive, because a lot of those notes I took at conferences didn't really have anything to cling to in my tiny brain. So they were telling me, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't connecting till, I don't know. So that's how I got going.
Jerry,
how about? So interesting. I started going to some really small writing conferences and taking some community writing classes. And I remember taking a plotting class early on, and I was just like, huh?
What?
I didn't understand it really. And that was so interesting. But joining Sisters in Crime was really a turning point for me. Julie Henricus, who's now the executive director, and I met at the banquet table at Malice Domestic. And she lived in the Boston area, and I was moving up there that summer, and she said, oh, you have to join the New England chapter of Sisters in Crime. And really, through the people I met there and the friends I met, I got the opportunity to write the Sarah series, because my editor at Kensington, my now editor, was looking for someone to write a garage sale mystery series, and he went to my agent, who went to my friend Barbara Ross, and I ended up writing a proposal for the series, and they bought it.
Love Barbara Ross.
Yeah, the same thing, much the same thing happened to me. So this, again, like Sherry's just told us, emphasized the importance of networking. I had written, I have a multi-part police procedural series, and I had written standalone psychological suspense, so I wasn't new. But I had this idea for a cozy series that I asked my friend Mary Jane Maffini, who everybody knows, if she would show it to her agent. And it was all I had was the three chapters and the proposal. Showed it to her agent. Her agent said to me, I really liked it, but I don't have a market for this. It was actually about a young Canadian paramedic working in a Caribbean island. She said, I there's no market for this. Sorry. So I thought, oh, that's the end of that. And then a couple of months later, she wrote to me, the agent wrote to me and said, I have a proposal from Penguin for a work for hire, and I wonder if you'd be interested in putting in an offer. So I did that. So the work for hire, I did, you know, the standard three chapters and an outline, and that's my Lighthouse Library series, published by written by Eva Gates, and we're now up to book 9 in that series, and it opened the door to all my other cozy series. So yeah, networking is really important. It's important as well. We're talking about the benefits to your career, absolutely, but for the friendship and the camaraderie, and I have found the mystery writing community to be so supportive and such a great bunch of people, and everybody's really supportive of each other's careers. And I know people that are, you know, literary writers, particularly in Canada, that means you're way up here, far, far above us common mystery writers. And apparently that they hate each other because they're all competing for the same prizes and the same, you know, limited number of contacts and the same, you know, funding and all that kind of stuff. So I'm happier down here as a mystery writer.
Sherry, you mentioned that. Well, go ahead, Julie.
Listening to Sherry, that's how I got to know her through Sisters in Crime. So I feel like I was remiss in not pointing out Sisters in Crime made a big difference in my confidence and my camaraderie, like you mentioned, Vicki. My local Sisters in Crime, here's me name dropping. My one little chapter here, you know, 20 minutes up the road as Kylie Logan, Amanda Flower, Vivian Chen. I mean, and they're fantastic. And they've really been everything I've needed. So sometimes just having that friend one friend even can mean everything. I mean, you got a good group.
Yep.
Okay. I'm glad you circled back to Sisters in Crime. As I was going to ask Sherry, you're a past president. Mm-hmm. And past presidents are required to have a legacy project. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about yours?
Sure. So my legacy project was to start what is called the Pride Award, and it's for an emerging writer in the LGBTQIA+ community. And so the backstory is that the last time BasherCon was in New Orleans, which was 5 or 6 years ago, they did a panel on, Sisters in Crime did a panel on diversity. And one of the speakers, Greg Heron, spoke about how his books were in a different section in bookstores. They were in a gay section instead of being on the regular shelves with everybody else. And that really struck me. And at the time, I had no idea I'd ever be the president of Sisters in Crime. And so when I knew I had to do a legacy project, I really admire our Eleanor Taylor Bland grant award for emerging crime writers of color. And so I wanted to do something similar. And fortunately, the board was on board with my idea, and it became a reality this year. And our first winner is actually from New Jersey, CJ Prince.
And people can find out information about this on
sistersincrime.org.
And is it for unpublished authors or?
You can have limited publication. You can't be prolific by any means. So we're kind of looking at what that means because, you know, we had some people enter that had written a bunch of poetry which really has nothing to do with crime writing fiction. So we're still redefining what that means for this next year's award.
Okay. I know you all had books that just came out on Tuesday, but I'm pretty sure those books have been finished for at least a year or so, and you're working on your next one. So what's next for each of you, either in this series or another series? Vicki, why don't you? I feel like...
Okay, well, my next book that's coming out on September is the first in a new series that I'm really excited about. This is coming out from Penguin, and it's the Catskill Resort series, and it's set in 1953 in a resort in the Catskills. And I'm excited about that because I had so much fun, basically, with the research, the clothes, the food, everybody's constantly smoking, and and the telephone, and the second book there, they're very excited because someone they know owns a television. They have a television in their house, and this is terribly exciting. And the mother says, we must get ourselves one of those televisions. So I enjoyed that a lot. It's set in the Catskills, so sort of thing, Dirty Dancing, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And the first one is called Deadly Summer Nights, and it comes out September the 7th from Penguin. I have a new Sherlock Holmes Bookshop series book coming out in January called A Three-Book Problem. That'll be book 7, I think, in the Sherlock Holmes series. And then in the spring, the next Lighthouse Library series called Death by Beach Read, and that, as I've said, is written under my pen name, Aviva Gates. And the third TBC series is written and finished and sent in, and it already has a title, which is Murder Spills the Tea, and that'll be late next summer. So enough to keep me busy for a while.
How about you, Julie?
Let's see. So Cider House Rules, I'm going over this here. Cider House Rules just came out this week, and I have 8 more releasing this year.
Wow.
Wow.
Next month is Partners in Lime. That's book 6 in my Seaside Cafe Mysteries with Sourcebooks. Did I say I write them as Bree Baker? My brain's going in circles. Then in September, I have a Harlequin coming out, Romantic Suspense, and it is called Kentucky Crime Ring. And then my next Romantic Suspense comes out then in October, and it is called Stay Hidden. In October, earlier in October than the Romantic Suspense, I have my third in the Christmas Tree Farm Mysteries with Crooked Lane as Jacqueline Frost. I'm super excited about that. And then also starting in September, I'm launching a new cozy series on my own. That was my brainchild during the pandemic. I'm going to try the other side of publishing and see what that is like. So books 1 through 4 come out September, October, November, December, and they are the Bonnie and Clyde mysteries, wherein Bonnie is a second chance dress shop. She refurbishes, recycles things, and Clyde is her little black cat kitty companion. Mm-hmm. And that starts with Burden of Poof in September.
Sherry, how about?
Yeah, I really feel like a slacker here. I really admire Vicki and Julie. They're so prolific, but they're also just lovely human beings. And, they're the kind of people if you need help with something, that they would be there for you. So it's really nice to be on this panel with them. My third book in the Chloe Jackson Mysteries, Three Shots to the Wind, comes out next March. And I'm writing the fourth one right now, which doesn't have a title yet.
It's really amazing that one good thing I feel like that came out of the pandemic is these panels. I could never have Vicki from Canada come all the way to New Jersey to my library.
I was just going to say, I travel everywhere. Everywhere. I'll go anywhere in the United States.
So let me rephrase it. I can't pay to have you come to library in New Jersey.
Hopefully one day before too much longer, I'll be able to start traveling to do personal appearances again.
And the same thing, even Ohio and Virginia, unless you were in my area, if VoucherCon were in the area.
You're right. That can always be arranged.
So where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
Go ahead. My webpage is VickiDelaney.com, spelling of my name is a little tricky, so it's VickiDelaney.com. I'm on Facebook as Eva Gates Author. I'm on Instagram and Twitter as Vicki Delaney. My books are available just about everywhere fine books are sold, and I'm always happy to have talked with by email. If they want to, you know, talk to me or set up some kind of a book club or a chat like this, I'm happy to. And my address is simply Vicki@VickiDelaney.com.
Go ahead, Julie.
So my website is julianlindsay.com. You can find out all about my books and everything there. As for social media, I'm usually on Facebook. I find most of my readers and just like the whole world is on Facebook. So I have an author page. I think it's like Julian Lindsay Author or something. And then if you wanted to keep up like daily all the time, I have a reader group that's just me and a couple hundred. Like it's a smaller group and we just talk cozies every day. And that's called my Cozy Queens. And you can find it on my Facebook page.
So my author website is sherryharrisauthor.com. On Twitter, I'm S. Harris Author, I think. I'm on Instagram as Sherry Harris Author. I also blog with the Wicked Cozy, Wicked Authors Now. We changed our name from Wicked Cozies. And it's a really fun blog. We have lots of guests. We give away lots of books. And it's just a fun way and to talk to us.
Vicki, I saw your hand.
I put my hand up because I'm going to be on Wicked's in September with my Catskill Mysteries. I forgot to mention that I also am a regular blogger at Mystery Lover's Kitchen, which is a hugely popular blog, and we talk recipes and how they relate to our books. And on Facebook, I'm part of the Cozy Mystery crew.
I'm glad you mentioned recipes. Do each of your books have recipes in them?
The Tea by the Sea books do. The Tea by the Sea books do stuff that she would make and serve in her tea room. My own scone recipe was actually featured in Tea Time magazine last year in time for the first book to come out. And I like doing that. My other books don't, but those ones do.
How about you? Sherry, do you have drink recipes maybe?
There aren't any. I will probably put a few up on my website. I tried to do that already and the page didn't show up, so I don't know what happened. and the garage sale mysteries have garage sale tips in them. So.
Oh, nice.
How about you, Julie?
I do three recipes, I think, in each book. In my Seaside Cafes and in my Apple, in my Cider Shop books have... So the cafe books are a little more like you get at a cafe, right? And iced tea recipes. But my Cider Shop books are a lot of fun because they're things that I grew up eating. So we've got like Hank's Mama's Dump Cake and fried bologna and, you know, some kind of tasty tater salad and things that you get when you go down and you have a nice little community gathering.
Nice.
There are definitely no recipes in my Catskills Resort Mysteries. Because I've been asked to do a couple of guest blogs, and I've been asked for a recipe. I don't want to make any recipes out of the Catskill. Like what am I going to have? You know, Jell-O salad with canned pineapple and ham with pineapple. And no, there's nothing much there that I want. Angel Food Cake is the one good thing I think that they had there, so maybe I can do that. But generally speaking, not interested in 1950s recipes.
Well, I want to thank Vicki, Julie, and Sherry once again. For spending an hour with us. It's been a lot of fun and best of luck with your books. They're all available at the library or they will be shortly. And thanks again to Larissa. And thanks everybody for watching.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. It's been lots of fun chatting to everybody.
It has been. So good luck everyone with your next book.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, I want to thank everyone at Kensington Books who made this possible, Sherry Harris, Vicki Delaney, and Julianne Lindsay. We really appreciate them taking the time out to talk about their new books. Jim Gannot will be in at 1 o'clock to take care of some business. Next week, it's just going to be me talking all about the library and some of the exciting upcoming events we have. The week after that, August 12th, I will have author Lucy Burdett. She's been on the show before, but this time we're actually going to get to see her rather than just have her on the phone. And then August 19th is going to be a banner day. We're going to have two in-studio guests, Bob Benjamin and Al Kratzer, who have their first graphic novel out, Head to Head. So I'm really looking forward to that. And until then, remember, wherever you are, you can call, stop in, or go online. Your library is always there for you. Have a good week.
USA Radio News.
I'm Brad Bernards. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell appeared to indicate that the central bank is less concerned about another wave of COVID infections than it had been about earlier waves. Powell pointed out that the second wave of infections that hit last summer had less of an economic impact than expected, in part because the states did not impose as severe lockdowns and because many households and businesses had adjusted to better deal with the pandemic. As dozens of wildfires rage in the West, the governors of California and Nevada are touring their state lines to get a first-hand look at the devastation. California Governor Gavin Newsom.
It just can't happen soon enough because the consequences of what we're all experiencing all across the Western United States.
Flames and smoke from the Dixie Fire are making firefighting efforts difficult, and there are concerns that strong winds and high temperatures could worsen the blaze. This is USA Radio News.
They're calling it the new socialism. More and more Democratic lawmakers want everyone to get a basic income, even if they don't work. Free health care, free college, and more. Now, every night this week, Rob Schmidt is on Newsmax pushing back on the new socialism and its leaders like AOC and Bernie Sanders. Joe Biden's spending programs are already costing you trillions as inflation is soaring. If you care about your money, you need to watch Rob Schmidt tonight. Find out why socialism doesn't really work and how it actually can cost you a lot. Get Newsmax TV on all major cable systems. If your operator doesn't carry it, call them and demand Newsmax or you can switch. Also, find Newsmax for free on most streaming systems like Roku, Samsung, LG, Pluto, Zumo, and more. Or download the free Newsmax app on your phone and watch it anywhere. More than 30 million Americans are tuning into Newsmax because it's news they can trust.
The U.S. Senate, in a 67-32 procedural vote Wednesday, advanced a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, despite the fact that the full text of the proposal hasn't been made public yet. CBS correspondent Natalie Brand.
Now what we have is senators, enough of them, more than 60, agreeing to move forward to debate on this physical infrastructure package. But this is a process that has many more procedural steps ahead.
A major shallow earthquake off the Alaskan Peninsula late Wednesday prompted tsunami warnings for much of the Gulf of Alaska coastline. They were lifted several hours later, though an advisory remained in effect. The region was being hit with numerous aftershocks. Only small waves were generated. A tsunami watch issued for Hawaii was later canceled. There were no initial reports of injuries or damage. This is USA Radio News.
Look, bud, I said your money or your life. I'm thinking it over.
The Great Gildersleeve.
Yeah. The new Edgar Bergen Hour with Charlie McCarthy.
Now, if you say help me, I'll mow you down.
3 hours a day, 7 days a week of the greatest radio shows of all time, classic radio theater, available on many of these radio stations or available on demand anytime at any podcast app by searching USA Classic Radio Theater. USA Classic Radio Theater.
Department of Justice officials alerted states on Wednesday that they're closely tracking the 2020 election audit taking place in Arizona and proposed audits in several other states. The new guidance document summarizes the Biden administration's position on federal law concerning audits, deeming the round of reviews that are either complete, in progress, or being proposed to be unusual and exceedingly rare, while highlighting that federal law imposes constraints under which counties and states must comply.
This document sets down a marker that says the Justice Department is concerned about this. Officials noted that Attorney General Merrick Garland said last month that the DOJ would focus in part on scrutinizing audits to make sure that they comply with federal laws. The United States is expected to delay a partial rollback of a controversial migrant expulsion policy, citing fears related to the fast-spreading Delta variant of the coronavirus. More from Dan Naraki.
The Biden administration is reportedly reconsidering its plan to lift restrictions that kept migrants from applying for asylum at the southern border to fight the spread of COVID. The White House was expected to lift Title 42 this summer, but after the recent rise in new infections due to the Delta variant, Politico reporting that the restrictions will stay in place for now. The administration was expected to begin to loosen the Trump-era restrictions at the end of July. From the USA Radio News Ohio Bureau, I'm Dan Naraki.
For USA Radio News, I'm Brad Bernards.